You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 188.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. This episode, I almost feel a little bit awkward having video for this episode. I think the subject matter, like, I almost want it to be audio only so I can hide my face. But here we are in person doing
you
this.
You have nothing to be ashamed of,
Matt. No, it's not that I'm ashamed of something, but it's the thoughts in this episode and maybe even the, like, partially the emotions, but also, like, trying to reach deep into my memory banks in this episode might require me to, like, scrunch up my face a little bit more than normal. And also, I often see this episode as us laughing and having a good time. Maybe we'll get to do that a little bit on this episode, but, you know, it's the 9/11 episode, so I don't know how much of that we're going to do. So listen, it's been 20 years since 9/11. I'm not very good at dramatizing things. I'm not going to give you a play-by-play. I don't want to make a huge political statement here. I'm not good at doing a memorial. Other people are good at that. And also, you're going to see on the TV over and over again all sorts of documentaries and stuff. But I did want to talk about it because it's an important event in history, but also, like, in our lives. And so I think it's important to mark 20 years. And I thought we can combine some, like, personal recollections with a little bit of research as well to try to explain to people who maybe are under 25 what going through that was like, maybe to explain to future generations what going through that was like. They have tons of stuff on what going through that was like, but hey, like, you know, the personal perspective and, you know, where we grew up, what our recollections were, might be a little bit different than the stuff that you're going to get, in most dramatization. So I thought that might be a worthwhile thing to do.
Absolutely. And a lot of people have made the comment that, you know, after 9/11, you know, everything was different starting on September 12th, that it was a different world. It was a dividing line for our lives, that for our generation, it was maybe like the equivalent of the Kennedy assassination.
Sure.
And so we're going to try and unpack that a little bit and give some clarity to what that everything was different really means, because that's
right.
That's it's an easy thing to say, but a little bit harder to really understand.
One of the things that we cover on this show, which I wasn't really expecting to cover when we started, but now it seems inevitable now that we do it, is sort of thinking about change, just changes in the world and how to anticipate them and how to think about them. So we've actually gotten pretty good at that. So we can cover some of that. Now, 20 years is a long time. So I want to start by taking us back only 10 years and just remember the day that bin Laden was finally captured and killed by SEAL Team 6. So already 10 years is a different world 10 years ago.
It's hard to believe that was a full decade ago.
Yeah, yeah. So do you remember that? Because there's interesting video on YouTube that I just don't think would happen today at a baseball game like the Mets and the Phillies, where, you know, this was happening on the news and they put it up on the screen and people shouting like USA, USA, you know, after basically 10 years of a manhunt for a single person, basically, the number one terrorist in the world. And I have a few memories. So that was when Foursquare was getting started up. That was when Foursquare was hitting its inflection point. I did not work there yet. But I remember that Foursquare users created a venue down at the World Trade Center called Osama Bin Ganathon. And everybody was checking into that. There were like random parties on the streets of New York. I don't know if you remember this.
I don't remember that specifically. My only distinct memory from that was the not quite literal but figurative mic drop speech that Obama made when he announced it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And that's it sticks in my memory. But it's in retrospect, it seems like a weird thing to celebrate the
death of a person.
Yeah,
yeah, it really does.
It's a loaded term, but ostensibly the assassination of an individual.
Right.
Not that he didn't have it coming, but We didn't capture him and put him on trial. They didn't try to exfiltrate him. Maybe that was the mission. I haven't done a lot of detailed reading up on that, but it seemed like that was extremely low priority in terms of what they went there to do.
So, I mean, and it's crazy that that was 10 years ago. So now we're almost as far as that was from 9/11 itself.
Yeah.
Which, might be a little bit of a way to explain some of the events, happening more recently. I'm not sure, but maybe I'll throw that out there. So, all right, we went to 2011. That doesn't happen. That crazy situation doesn't happen unless 9/11 happens. So let's rewind and let's talk about, what was life like in America pre-11? I have so many things I could talk about on this. So I kind of racked my brain a little bit. Maybe I can go through my list. You can react. So in terms of technology, we just had broadband internet. That was like brand new. People were getting it in their homes. We'd had it at the universities and the schools for a while. We just had like Wikipedia. We just had, so like, it wasn't like you can go on Twitter and break news on Twitter, but there were definitely lots of journalists out there and, different that would break news on the internet pretty fast. And email was kind of the Twitter of its day because you'd be on these long lists and people were sending jokes back and forth and
all the chain emails. We weren't yet in peak blogging, but it was kind of the precursors to that.
Well, blogging was a big deal during the Clinton scandals and all that. So it was just getting going. And there, like, the internet was brand new. Like, when that was happening, you have to call to get online. So really, that's how new it is. Like, it was probably a lot of people. I don't know. I think I was still on broadband at that point, or on dial-up at that point.
I'm trying to remember when we got when we replaced the dial-up in our home. And it
might have been 02.
It must have happened in at some point in high school, but I couldn't put my finger on when.
Yeah. So at this point, but you can go online in the library and in the school very fast. And I know that sound. I know people who don't remember this might be like, wait, what? Like, why would that sounds crazy? But it was actually kind of easy. I don't know. It felt kind of easy at the time to do it. It didn't feel like a pain at all. But there weren't that many websites to check, so you didn't really have to do that much when you went on it. You just check your email and. I don't know, a few chat rooms, news stories at the time. The millennium Y2K bug, that was always a big joke to me. Like, some people say, oh, people really thought the world was going to end. I always, like, even in the 98, 99, I always interpreted that as a big joke. I don't know what you remember of that, but
I think there was some legitimate concern about certain systems crashing.
I'm just saying what I was.
End of the world was definitely hyperbole, but I was watching with anticipation and curiosity, like, is something going to happen? What's it going to be? I wasn't hunkered down in the basement with cans of soup and lots of D batteries.
I have an amazing home video of that night that I took with me and my cousins on, celebrating the millennium. And we blew up like 100 balloons and put it in one room so we can like kick them around. And, I had the camcorder and, we did a little pretend thing. I mean, I know maybe I'm a little too old for pretend. I was like 15 at the time. No, but we did a whole thing where we were like, simulating a terrorist attack, because that was actually something that people talked about a lot at the time. There were a lot of terrorist attacks that had been thwarted. There were a lot that were successful. There was the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. There was the Oklahoma City bombing and there were school shootings just like today. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to get into the whole, it had to do with someone who was in the bathroom and, I'll let some of that be private stuff, but, let's involve poison gas, but let's not, it was kind of a big joke.
Well, one of the other things you have here in the notes is cell phones, which, and I can't for the life of me remember when I got my first cell phone. It may not have been until I got to college, but it may have also been you know, like senior year-ish. But these were not smartphones. These were barely even dumb phones. They were just the side of you know, Wall Street, you know, brick size mobile phones.
And look, I mean, at the Osama bin Ghanathon, 10 years later, people still had dumb phones.
Yeah, well, I remember in college, some people, they didn't have unlimited texting on their plan. And so, you know, they'd say, don't include me on your text chain because it costs me a nickel every time someone sends me a text.
That's so ridiculous. Yeah, no, I didn't get it through college, but I feel like cell phones were becoming very common among, like, adults, of yes. which I was not one yet.
And I think that played into some of the events of the day. I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here because there were certainly a lot of adults trying to get a hold of folks. And I believe the cellular system was overloaded significantly.
Right, right. And also people were using cell phones on, again, jumping ahead on Flight 93.
Right, yeah.
To call their relatives and also... That's how they found out that this plane was not being hijacked, you know, to be taken to some country and negotiated. This plane was being hijacked as a suicide mission. And so,
that's another way that this was a huge game changer in terms of kind of the threat matrix, that hijackings were not unusual. And maybe they'd gone down in frequency since the 70s, but they were kind of a known issue. But the way you dealt with those, it was a very different nature of threat than what we saw unfold that day. Again, getting ahead of myself there.
Right, right. So, getting into pop culture now, and on one hand, this could just be it seems this way because you know people often have. Positive recollections of their youth. But I honestly don't think I would feel this way if I were in high school in 2021, that pop culture and the media actually seemed pretty upbeat at the time in 2000 and 2001.
Maybe shallow, but...
Absolutely shallow. But I mean, when wasn't it shallow?
I don't think it's just nostalgia there. I mean, where does this fit in terms of the dot-com boom?
During
the economy was chugging along strong. We'd gotten through the Y2K scare with no significant issues there.
And the dot-com boom affected people in tech, but it wasn't the kind of economic, didn't cause the same kind of economic PTSD, for lack of a better term, that the 2008 housing crash caused. Definitely economic PTSD for people in the tech industry.
I wasn't even thinking about the crash that followed the boom, but yeah.
No, it was like coming off the boom, and it was a real boom in terms of applications. Like, the internet was a game changer, and it was still so new that it was, and this lasted probably until 10 years ago, until basically 2013, 2014, when the internet started, reached its peak and started its downward dive into the depths of despair. I have written down here, I remember the 2000 election really well, and it might sound, you know, similar, if you read it in a textbook years from now, it might sound similar to 2020, but it really was not living through it. Looking through it now, it seems like it wasn't really a culture where the struggle was among politicos. Like I picture like the people protesting in like button down, things like it was now. Like,
it was a big deal at the time.
It's like, who's going to get the jobs.
And it was unprecedented, but I'd say it was an order of magnitude less, bitter is not the right term for it, but
it was a lot like, oh, this is a very fascinating case.
there was a certain element of this was a battle between gentlemen, that there was a certain, even though they may have disliked each other personally or opposed each other politically, there was a certain amount of respect among all the parties, which did not exist in our last two presidential elections.
Sure. So that was going on. I I went ahead and looked up some of the top 40 music that was playing on the radio. I saw some J-Lo, Mary J. Blige, and TLC.
I know that those are names of artists, but I'd say there's at least a 70% chance that I would not have known that
I would
in 2001.
I'm into, I was into that.
Yeah, I was pretty oblivious.
Okay. Okay, so that happened. But also, that was Britney Spears was coming up, and Eminem, and Christina Aguilera, and all that. So it was, I guess Eminem is kind of more, I feel like he's more of the 2000s, a little more of a downcast type of situation. But you had that. Okay, now people say, well, airports before 9/11. And this one is a little bit puzzling to me because I flew a few times before 9/11 and I don't remember that big of a difference in security, but it could have been because I wasn't really trying to get through and I wasn't trying to bring a big bag of food through or whatever, but you could definitely get more through security then. You still had to go through the metal detector and put your bags through a thingy mabob, and that's kind of the thing that I do now. But now I have a TSA pre-approved, so maybe that got me kind of back to where it was. I'm sure if I go, you still have to take off your shoes and if you're not. So,
I have a couple of thoughts on that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'd done any air travel pre 9/11 that I can remember. I mean, there was a trip to Florida when I was like two that I have absolutely no memory of, but I don't have any distinct memories of air travel.
You went on the middle school trip to Washington, D.C., right?
Did we fly for that?
We
I
did.
Can't even remember.
We did fly.
Well, yeah, it shows how crisp that is in my mind. I think the pop culture reference that goes along with that is you had so many romantic comedies where somebody's love interest is going away to college or for a big job in another city.
That was the end of Friends.
And they have to run through the airport to tell them, don't go, I choose you. And that was something that you could actually go to the gate for in an airport when you didn't have a ticket to get on that plane.
Yeah.
And maybe you had to, go through the metal detector, but that's something that just doesn't even make sense in the current context. It's like seeing movies from the 90s or pre-90s and people today saying, where's everybody's cell phone? Why are they going in that small glass box to call somebody?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that almost reminds me, I didn't even have this written down in the notes, but do you remember the movie Meet the Parents?
Yep.
So at the end, he gets on the plane and he gets into a fight with the stewardess, and he says bomb, and they're like, can't say bomb on an airplane. He's like, I'm not gonna bomb, and they take him out. So that was very that was kind of too on the mark because that was 1999, and then they take him out, and then it turns out it's actually Robert De Niro.
Like I said before, the hijacking threats were a very different beast back then. Maybe there was a bomb on an airplane, but it was usually because that's the threat to get you to do this other thing that I want you to do, which was usually like fly me to Cuba or, fly me to Libya or wherever the place, that you wanted to escape to.
Right.
That was beyond the jurisdiction of the Western power you were currently in.
Right. Right.
And the playbook was usually, just do what they say, there were subtle ways of notifying air traffic control that you were experiencing hijacking, and they would do things on the ground. But, there was no concept of they're going to crash this thing into the ground and all the lives are,
right.
It was very much like bank robberies that, if you do what they say, then nobody's going to get hurt and everything's insured and it'll turn out fine.
And I actually don't remember any specific hijackings that occurred in our lifetime before that. I know some occurred in the 70s. But
yeah, I'd say it was going out of style as a common activity, but I haven't looked up what the stats are and how frequently it actually did happen in the 90s.
Right, right. Okay, so I had...
there was one other thing I wanted to mention about airports. So I was not a stellar Spanish student, but I did take Spanish in high school. And if you were more dedicated to your foreign language than I was, there was an opportunity. I think it was over spring break. Students could go on a trip to Spain with one of the teachers. And one of the things that that invariably almost all of the boys who went on this trip would do is they would purchase a sword in Spain. I don't know if they actually went to Toledo, the city that's famous for manufacture of swords, but they would purchase a sword in Spain. And in this pre-9/11 world, yes, you would have to, you could bring it through security. You probably had to like,
so that's hand crazy. It. You could just bring a sword through security.
You know, it was in its package, and you would hand it to whoever the security person was, and they'd check it and say, okay, yep, that's a sword, and then they hand it back to you when you walk through the metal detector. And then when you boarded the airplane, you would hand it to the flight attendant or the chief steward or whoever, and they'd say, okay, we're gonna put this up in the cockpit with the pilot, and you can get it when you disembark. And that's just so bizarre in the context that we're in now with armored cockpits, and once that door closes, it'll never be open again.
That reminds me, I got in trouble with a sword at TSA once in 2016. Did I ever tell you about this?
I don't know if I've heard this.
Okay. Story. Well, no. So I was in Africa, in West Africa, in Ghana in 2016. And before I left, they were trying to sell stuff to us. And someone's like, buy this sword. I'm like, it's pretty cool to have a sword, but I don't think I can get it through security. He's like, oh, no, it's not a problem. Just put it in your check bag. Just put it in your check bag. So I... Yes, I forgot to put it in my check bag. So it was in my backpack. And the security in Ghana wasn't really, didn't catch that. So I went on that 10-hour flight all the way from Ghana to DC. Then I didn't sleep a bit on that flight. So I was just completely delirious. I had a long bus ride from what's one of the DC airports to Reagan Airport?
Yeah, there's Reagan and
Dulles, I think.
Dulles is the other one. Okay. Right in DC.
I had to take a shuttle with all my bags, and it was just it took forever. And then I finally got to Reagan Airport, and it was maybe 7 in the morning, and I try to go through security and they flagged me and I couldn't go through several times, and the guy was very nervous when he was opening my bag, and he said, do you have any weapons in here? I'm like, no, I don't have any weapons. It's all cool. Just check whatever you need. And he's like, if I put my hand in here, is something going to hurt me? I'm like, no, just look through my stuff. Let me go. So, and then he pulls out a sword and they're like, sir, what is this? And I said, it's an Ashanti warrior sword. And they said, well, you can't take an Ashanti warrior sword on the plane with you. So fortunately, I was able to check the bag. I didn't get arrested and stuff, because I would not have been, when you're up for 48 hours, I don't know how I would have been under questioning. I don't think I would have remembered to not submit to questioning, but because it was a domestic flight still, because I already went through. Right. It was a separate flight. It wasn't even I set it up. One of those things where it wasn't even a connecting flight. I set it up as a separate flight. But
that would not have been a good time.
No, so it wasn't a border crossing. So, but yeah. No, they let me go. But I could have gotten in big trouble for that.
I guess the other airplane.
But it was not a very dangerous sword. I mean, maybe it was. I don't know. I just don't know how to use it.
You don't sound very convincing with the words in that statement.
Come on, but it's not a dangerous sword.
I mean, there's the stereotypical story of young child on an airplane for the first time, and the flight attendant asks, oh, do you want to come up to the cockpit and see what it's like, and the pilot will show you around during the flights. That no way that happens anymore.
They still do that before flight sometimes.
So that's good to know. Yeah, I haven't seen that, but yeah.
If you get your kids on a small plane, they might be able to do that pre-flight.
I'll have to remember that next time we're flying with the kids.
Just knock on the cockpit door and be like, let us in. No, it's usually open before the flight. So I actually had two big flights that year. So I went on the school trip to France, and unlike the Spain trip, you didn't have to be a very good French student to go. So I went to France. I actually liked the trip to France. I didn't know too much French. I took French, so I guess I knew some French, but, you know, not enough to get around. So there was that airport thing. And I remember a lot of security. I mean, it was still a hassle to go to the airport. It was still a hassle doing an international flight back then. And then my second flight was to Michigan. I went on and so this would already be in August of 2001. I was about to say 2011, August of 2001. I went to the a program in the University of Michigan. It was let's call it math camp. It was a 2-week thing where you learn about the concept of infinity from a math professor at the University of Michigan, some of which I've actually shared on this program, some of the same things that we went over there 20 years ago, which is hard to believe. And when I went back, I actually struck up a conversation with the person sitting next to me, which is, now that I think about it, would have been pretty rare for me. It would be pretty rare for me now, and would be like very rare for me at age 17. So it turned out that the guy next to me was, a Muslim guy, was a student, and he literally had like a book about, Islam that he was reading, and we were talking. And I remember on the way in, I was just showing him, because I'm very good at like maps and stuff, and I was showing him all the sites in New York. And I remember saying like, "Oh, look, there's the World Trade Center. There's the Twin Towers." So I don't know if I want to give that story, but that's just something that I really remember very well, because that was just right before. So then later on in the summer, I went to, I think the guy was from Morocco, by the way. So that was really interesting. So then I took a trip to New York City before 9/11 as well. I think it was coming in and out from one of the college trips. You probably remember this. You go on all this. Oh, yeah. We went on one together. It was a college I never applied to, but, do you remember what that was?
I do not. Do you remember what state it was in?
Williams, Massachusetts. Was it that, okay. Massachusetts? Yeah.
I definitely visited Williams at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was with me. Or I guess I tagged along, I guess. I don't. Did you apply? I don't think I applied.
I think I did. I applied to at least a dozen schools. Oh, okay, and this is, like you said, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, that was like my, I think I was in New York City for a college trip. And at the time, my grandparents hadn't moved to New York City yet, but my uncle was in the same building that they would be in. So I was in that building and in the pool. You could see the Twin Towers very well in the distance, just like now you could see the World Trade Center in the distance. So that would have been, that was sometime that summer I was there. Another thing during that summer was, it wasn't like in New York City, but I was crossing Canal Street. It might have been one of these trips where it was like, okay, we for some reason have to take the Brooklyn Bridge. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense now that I think about it. You have to take like the Brooklyn Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, and cross Canal Street. Like, I've done that before, but I don't remember why we were doing it. So maybe we were visiting people on Long Island, and then we're going directly to a college in like either in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or something like that. That probably makes a lot more sense. And I think right there, you pass right by the World Trade Center site. Maybe not right by, but pretty darn close. Like, Canal Street is not, it's maybe like a quarter mile away or so. It's like, 5 blocks or 10 blocks. But it was like, right, like I remember looking up and seeing them above me, not in the horizon. So, and this must have been 2-3 weeks before 9/11. Wow. Yeah. So I'm going to go into post 9/11 afterward. We have some things written here that's like post 9/11 stuff. We'll bounce that out until afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to go to a UN document Not just a UN document, but a whole UN trip. So you remember this trip that we took? Oh my God! So I found this in my parents' basement. We actually were given this pamphlet, this exact pamphlet, and this is how I wrote my name, back in 2001. Why were we on? Why did we go to the UN? Do you remember that? And why were there so few people? Like, who got to go?
So we went. I think this was our AP US history class, right? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
I think Mrs. Bennett was the orchestrator of this.
Yeah.
I don't know if we applied for it or if she selected her most promising students and asked if we were interested. But yeah, it was were there like maybe a dozen of us who went, something like that?
Yeah. It was fun.
So I guess it was something run by the United Nations International School, which
I had never heard of at the time.
I assume that that's, you know, if you are a UN delegate or on the UN staff, then when you move to Manhattan to work there, your kids go to this school rather than going to the New York City public school system. It's a very international group, and they were inviting groups from schools around the country to come in for this kind of, I think it was an annual event that they do. I did not ever do quote unquote model UN, but my impression was that this was kind of like model UN on steroids. I thought the coolest part of the whole trip was that we actually got to sit on the floor of the General Assembly.
Yeah, you got to sit at a country. I don't remember what country we sat at.
I think it was one of the African nations, but you saw there were the little microphones and the buttons for voting there, and we got to, you know, speak on the floor of the...
It was like a giant classroom. Assembly. Now, I kind of felt out of place. I kind of felt like our little delegation was a little out of place there. Did you? Like, I felt like there were all these, like, UN school people who were on a whole different level of, like, they were basically kids of diplomats and stuff.
There was some of that, and maybe part of it was that folks from the other schools who were there were involved in Model UN type stuff, and so they were a lot more steeped in this kind of thing.
Yeah.
This was new experience.
That was back when I was kind of like impressed by that stuff, and then that I think after I went to Yale, I was like, okay, I don't need to be impressed anymore. So I found the trip to be eye-opening. Probably not eye-opening in the way that they intended. I sort of feel like some of the speeches were like, oh my God, some of this UN stuff is a little cultish. Especially the speech by Harry Belafonte.
I was going to say, that's the only name I remember from the day.
So he's like, it's like, oh wow, this guy has a famous song about bananas. And now he's telling us that we need the global government. What's going on here?
I was impressed because it enabled me to name drop him. But
yeah.
I think I had a similar reaction to the actual content of his speech.
Yeah. And what's interesting, if I go through this booklet today, it's like all of the problems that they list, like most of them are still problems. It's been another 20 years. They haven't solved most of them.
Well, yeah, we don't have the time on this episode some to of them get have into got, our,
no,
our
no, no.
deeper thoughts on the UN as an organization, but
some of the problems have gotten worse.
I would say that not having solved any of the problems that we were facing 20 years ago is very on brand for the United Nations.
could have guessed. There's actually one of the most interesting things about this is that there's a huge section on Afghanistan, which was in the news then. It was in the news a few months later, and it's in the news today. And it's the news coming out of Afghanistan is not much different.
There's definitely some deja vu there.
Yeah. So there's actually two sections on Afghanistan. The first, and they seem like they're written by different authors, but the first kind of urges a peace deal between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. They were having a bit of a civil war there at the time, which... I think they are still. And that section was like not as negative toward the Taliban. It was probably a little bit more trying to be more objective, but not as negative towards the Taliban as a U.S. publication would be.
It was very much, I mean, not that this publication was being sent to Taliban officials, but it was
kids.
Written from the perspective of someone who very much wanted to bring them to the negotiating table, not to
yeah.
shame them and drive them away.
But it's also like written for kids, written right. for us, like for like teens. They did say that you know, the Taliban is accused of harboring all these drug lords and terrorists, but the focus was really on the drug lords. The focus was on the drug trade.
Yeah, which is interesting, and it's possible that at the time that was written, they didn't have all the stats on this yet. But I think it was the year before that. So in 2000, the Taliban had actually put in a ban on the farming of opium poppies. Stats that we have access to now, which like I said, may have been collected later on, showed that there was actually a 99% reduction in the cultivation of opium poppies. And it was heralded as perhaps the most effective anti-drug campaign ever.
I mean, the Taliban can crack some skulls there.
Yeah. At the time, I think they may have mentioned that the Taliban has claimed that they're cracking down on this, but there was a lot of skepticism. It was very much a, okay, yeah, we'll believe it when we see it kind of attitude.
Yeah.
Cause I think the Taliban had, they have a history of promising things and saying that they're going to do things a certain way and then not necessarily shaking out that way on the ground. So it wasn't unreasonable skepticism there. But right. It's an interesting factoid that they drove down the production on poppies for opium so dramatically, and the depressing follow-up to that is that and then the Taliban was kicked out, and in 2002 opium production shot right back up to its
sure.
its pre-ban levels.
Sure.
And is in a similar area today. In fact, I think there may be more opium coming out of Afghanistan today than there was in the pre-2000 period.
That's surprising. We haven't heard about the Taliban's new opium policy.
I think they're still anti-opium production, but I don't know that cracking down on that has been a priority of the new administration there.
Remains
to be seen.
I don't know. So they talk a lot about the opium trade. They say there's some terrorists. They don't mention bin Laden. They don't mention Al-Qaeda or anything like that. There's the second section is on the women in Afghanistan. And here this is written, you know, the Taliban really sounds quite brutal here and on some of the things they're doing. I don't want to get into the specifics, mainly because I don't remember exactly how it was written, but it wasn't just like, you know, it was...
There's a lot of real oppression there.
Yeah,
we're not talking about the gender pay gap being the issue.
Yeah,
okay.
Well,
again, a lot of the same things that we're concerned about happening today in the new Taliban administration.
I mean, okay, this is not. I'm like thinking, is this relevant to the episode? Do I want to get into the? Here it is: women in Afghanistan. Amnesty International, victims of violence, religious strife, hostilities. Women have been treated as spoils of war and subjected to rape and other form of torture. So yeah, this sounds pretty bad. Okay, so that was, we weren't like most Americans completely completely unexposed to what's going on in the rest of the world. I feel like there's this...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something that was being covered up by any means, but it also wasn't something you were hearing about on the news.
Right. So let's talk about what was in the news in the summer of 2001, because we're going to need a lot of water today. And then we're going to wrap up part one, which is going to be about the pre-9/11 world, and part two is going to be about the actual day, which... people should hang on for. That's why you want to subscribe to this podcast, because this is really interesting stuff. So the summer of 2001, that was a very quiet summer. It was a very quiet year. It was after the millennium, after Y2K, after the election. There was not much going on. And there are two stories that I remember from that year. They were both very... Well, I guess the Gary Condit story was not that ridiculous. I mean, here you had a congressman who his intern, 21-year-old intern, went missing. Apparently, they had some sort of relationship. We found out years later that, you know, she was killed and buried in the park, Chandra Levy. And, you know, we still don't know what that happened, but it's not exactly world-changing stuff. And then the second story, which is and he really got the media off him when 9/11 happened. So that's I don't think
I hesitate to call it a silver lining
for him. I mean, it didn't work. I don't think it worked out for him anyway. Okay, so that there was a bunch of news articles that summer about the scary rise in shark attacks, and they called it the summer of the shark. I'm going to read this from the New York Times archive. The title is "Scientists Say Frenzy Over Shark Attacks is Unwarranted." And this is the first sentence is pretty funny. With a summer season framed by a shark attack on a boy in Florida 2 days after the 4th of July, and the death of a man on Labor Day on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, the danger from sharks could easily be seen as rising dramatically. That almost sounds like, you know, shark attacks, there's one last year, two this year. It's like exponential growth.
Yeah, don't you know about exponential growth?
Then they go on. This is being seen as the summer of the shark, as Time magazine puts it in the July 30th cover story, bristling with images of razor-sharp teeth. So this was in all the news fit to print in the New York Times, September 5th, 2001. the reaction there was...
Was Shark Week a thing back then? Because if so, I think sharks done got scooped.
No, I think Shark Week was kind of a derivation of this, one of its descendants of this shark scariness. Because then we had the Sharknado movies... And
I have still yet to actually watch one of those.
I've watched one of them. It's quite an experience. Maybe I'll have you over here. We'll do a watching. It is quite an experience. Okay, so we're gonna get. Before we get to the day before 9/11. Ah, yes, movies that seem to foreshadow 9/11. People forget about this. But the World Trade Center in particular, the Pentagon too, but also the World Trade Center was featured in like a lot of movies and pop culture before 9/11. There, even a lot of like symbols of the city. You'd see the Twin Towers as like their silhouette being like a symbol of New York City.
Right up there with the Empire State Building.
Yeah, probably still should be. But I have written down some things I remember. There's the Mario Brothers movie, which... was not taken well by critics, but that's 1990. I'm sure I saw it on TV and I loved it, but it was in 1993, and they actually had, you know, a scene where, you know, the kind of World Trade Center goes from lovely day to like kind of desolate and like half destroyed in an instant, like when, you know, the bad guy almost snaps his finger, almost like a Thanos snap, but not quite that. They were in Back to the Future too, because, you know, that was about the wild and wacky future world of 2015, where you could have a window and that window could show whatever you want. And one of the options was a view of the World Trade Center. Independence Day, not only did it have the World Trade Center getting destroyed by the aliens and a scene where they're blowing up, but also it has 9/11 on the clock of how much time the president has left, 9 minutes and 11 seconds as he gets on his plane to escape DC. The Simpsons had something, I don't know what, but I feel like the Simpsons have just done everything that no matter what happens, they've predicted it. There was the Spider-Man trailer that you remember. Why don't you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. So I don't remember this at the time, but I remember hearing about it afterwards that, the Spider-Man movie didn't come out until 2002. This was the first one with Tobey Maguire, and the trailer they dropped. I think it was on like September 8th. Trailer for the movie coming out, you know, next spring, and it had a shot that involved the World the World Trade Towers, the World Trade Center towers. And I believe the original version of the film actually had the finale battle between Spider-Man and the villain.
Willem Dafoe, the Green Goblin.
I think it took place on or around the trade centers. And
there's a meme going around from him right now that's very popular. If I can remember, you know the one where he's like, "I'm a bit of a scientist myself."
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that movie is very influential. So sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, and so I believe so. 2 days after the towers went down, they did pull that trailer and locked it back up into the vault. And I believe they had to completely refilm, you know, reshoot, recut the finale scene, redo the special effects so that the World Trade Center Twin Towers do not appear in the movie.
Right.
Since that would very much have been too soon.
And also, like, it showed the clip you showed me, it had, you know, he built a web between the two towers and it had, you know, a helicopter, but an aircraft caught in that web. So that was pretty too close, dead on. Another one I want to mention is a 1998 film with Will Smith, again with Will Smith, because he also was Independence Day, but it's called Enemy of the State. That really was about, like, the rise of the surveillance state. But
I was going to say, that has much more of a Snowden Patriot Act thing to it. I didn't know if it involved the towers or not.
No, it didn't involve the towers, but it seems to hit on a lot of the issues that came to the forefront after 9/11. So, okay, now I want to take us right up to that point of September 2001. So let's just talk about what we were doing. Do you remember those first 2 weeks of high school? So we were going into our senior year, and basically it is going to be a lot easier than 11th grade. 12th grade is so much easier. I
don't know that I was feeling that level of relief at that point, because
we didn't have a college yet.
Is it like October is when the deadline for applications? I was probably procrastinating writing my essays. And I'm sure I hadn't finished filling out the Common Form app or whatever.
Yeah, first semester was still a little bit, but they do go easy on you. So we both had a free period at that point. Like, before that, you were going to class every single period of high school. And then in 12th grade, they're like, "We'll let you have a free period. It's just free. And if it happens to be the first one in the morning, you could sleep in. You don't have to get up at for 7:20 in the morning. You could now get up for 8 in the morning," which makes a big difference. Although now I can't imagine doing either, but you know, different time. So I was going to be in a play, or the, you know, they had the audition for The Crucible. We were doing The Crucible that year. I ended up getting, I was a Reverend Paris, so I was you know, putting people to death in that, I guess. Very dark play that was chosen before 9/11, but, you know, so I believe that the callbacks for that, so I think what happened was, and I could be wrong, it could have been the other way around, but I think we had already done, the week before, we had done auditions, and I think the callbacks were scheduled for 9/11/2001, and I think they were canceled that day, or maybe that was one of the auditions, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely something that day that was canceled, and then it was like, wow, it kind of felt like this whole thing, this whole play is going to be very different now, our whole production of it, because it just seems like things got a lot darker, a lot faster. I was also planning the video that I put you in, Dictator of Easton, before we started writing it, about the town next door invading our town. Very fun. We were going to do a 20th anniversary.
Was that all senior year?
That was all senior year. No, I hadn't really started writing it. I was just sketching it out when 9/11 happened. It's like, oh, okay, this is going to be very different now. I also went, I remember the day before, Monday night, I went to, I think, Stanford for like a thing on the University of Chicago, like trying to, you know, recruit. So like a, what was it? Like a Q&A they would do with the kids and their parents. I ended up visiting there. I think I did apply. So I was in that, we were just starting to get homework. I was just starting audition for the play, and that takes me to the morning of 9/11/2001. And I had to come in for my free period because I had like some class before that. So I didn't get to sleep in. Sadly. So what was your first 2 weeks like?
I don't have any crisp memories of exactly what was going on in the lead up to that. I do know that the morning of, I think I was in the school library at that point. I was probably working on a project or something. I did not become aware of what was going on until, I was walking through the halls, not during a changeover between classes, but during that first period of the morning.
Right.
I didn't have to be anywhere in particular. I may have in fact been heading over to the cafeteria.
So I was in the North cafeteria and you were heading to the North cafeteria. Very interesting. All right. And that brings us to the beginning. Why don't we take a break here? I know people are going to be like, no, I want to get into it, but nope, hang tight. Look, I don't know how Joe Rogan does these 3-hour things. This is a very heavy topic. So let's take a little bit of a break now. And when we come back next time, we'll talk about what happened that day and a little bit more research and a little bit more thoughts on it. How's that sound?
Sounds good. And the answer, Joe Rogan, it's definitely performance-enhancing drugs.
I'm sure. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.